Okay, this is Audacity. I'm Dominic. This is Josh. I wanted to say Matt Brubeck, who's another big Audacity developer, is also back there. And let's get started. If everyone who has a laptop, and if you want to participate or learn a little more about Audacity, go to audacityteam.org/codecon right now, and we have some files there for you to download. If you don't already have Audacity, you can install it. You probably have it working in 10 minutes or so by the time we get to the demo, and we have some audio files for you to play with right there so you can get started. Does everyone have the URL? audacityteam.org/codecon. So, very brief introduction if you don't know what Audacity is. It's a cross-platform, and that means Mac, Windows, Linux, most other Unixes, as long as we have access to the audio I.O. So, not the only problem with obscure Unix systems is if we don't have audio I.O. support. Introduced in 2000, I started working on it in 99. It's been on SourceForge right from the beginning. It records and edits sample audio, think like waveforms. We don't have MIDI support. It's a very general purpose audio editor. It's not like a techno music mixing program or like a super high-end multi-tracker. It's sort of right in between. It tries to handle the audio editing needs for most people and has a lot of kind of interesting and useful features. There, at any one time, lots of people are busy with other things. No one works on it full time. We have maybe two or three main developers, 4 to 6 active developers, and dozens of contributors who are hanging out in the development list, submitting patches or bug reports and other things like that. And we are looking for sponsors. We would love to have full time or even part time paid developers on this. So if anyone's interested. Audacity would not be possible without a number of other projects. Audacity is really kind of pulling together a lot of existing libraries, and we've done a lot of work developing some of these libraries in order to make Audacity possible, but a lot of other people are benefiting from those. One of the largest ones used to be called WX Windows. Just a couple days ago, they renamed to WX Widgets. It's under pressure from Microsoft. Yay for our friends up in Redmond. WX Widgets is a cross-platform GUI library in C++. It's the only cross-platform GUI library that is uses totally native widgets on all platforms. So on a Mac, you're getting real Carbon widgets. On Windows, you're getting real Windows, you know, buttons and scroll bars and everything like that. Port audio is cross-platform audio input and output. Libsound file lets us support dozens of uncompressed audio file formats, expat for our project files in XML, and a bunch of other libraries which are not strictly necessary but also very important, such as libmad for MP3, libvorbis. So Josh is going to talk about some of the things from the developer's perspective now.
Going off what Dominic said about all those libraries, we have some challenges that are introduced in making Audacity cross-platform, and I thought I'd talk just briefly about what some of them are, but why it's still useful and worth it for us to be cross-platform. The biggest challenge is just the fact that we have all those libraries in between us and the native APIs. That's WX Windows, that's Port Audio, and all of the other libraries we use have to be cross-platform too, so if they're not, we have to sometimes do some hacking around. If there are bugs in those libraries, we have to be talking with our upstream developers. If there's specific things on the platforms like OS X's interface builder that make it easy, we can't take advantage of that stuff. We have to kind of use the least common denominator that's available on all the platforms. And unlike the dream of Java, which is just you write it once and it automatically works everywhere, we don't have that perception. We have to write it in once and it works on the platform that it was written for, but then it has to be tweaked again for each other platform, usually in minor ways, but sometimes in more major ways. Just to give you an idea of some of the work beyond code that requires extra work, you have packaging. On Windows, that's going to be an installer program. On Linux, you have packaging formats like Debian RPM. And OS X, you usually distribute things using a disk image. GUI behaviors, it looks a little bit different from platform to platform, and that's some minor code. But there's also more substantial behaviors, like on OS X. OS X users expect that when you close all the projects that Audacity, the program, stays open, which is different than other platforms, so we have to code specific behavior like that. despite all that extra work, it's really useful to us. We really appreciate having a much wider exposure to more users. You can see from this graph can't do real justice because you don't get to see who's getting Audacity from Linux distributions. But what you can see is that we have a lot of Windows users, but still quite a substantial number of Mac users too. And beyond being useful to more users, we have people that are using more than one platform on a regular basis are going to have increased utility from Audacity. For example, we have heard reports of Audacity being used to teach high school and college classes because the instructor teaches the tool on whatever platform they're using in class, and then no matter what platform the students are going home to, Audacity is going to be there for them. And also it means that we have a lot more developers that are interested in doing useful work on Audacity. Most of our developers are really only interested in one platform, and if we weren't cross-platform, we wouldn't attract them at all. I'm going to move now into a time where I talk a little bit more about some of the underlying algorithms and data structures. Really, the biggest question when you're developing an audio editor is how to deal with that much data efficiently. The traditional ways to deal with this problem, the simplest way is just to always have all of your data in memory at the same time. The problem is this scales really, really poorly. If you ever have more data than you have memory, you're going to be swapping out all the time. An example of a program that uses this is Sweep for Linux. I mean, it's a good editor, but it can't work with all that much data at one time. The next step up from that is operating directly on a sound file. So, for example, if you open up a WAV file and then perform some edit on it, it performs that edit directly on the WAV file. The problem for that is that it's destructive, first of all. If you perform some edit, you don't have the file you started with anymore. And also, it's really inefficient for cut and paste because if you, for example, just delete the first sample from the beginning of the file, it has to scoot everything over one sample, which means rewriting the whole entire file. So the most common choice for more sophisticated programs is to use edit decision lists. And just briefly, the idea behind that is that you never modify data once it's on disk. And if you import a file, you read it in place, and whenever the user makes an edit of some kind, it just really makes a note of what the user has done. And then at playback time, it kind of pieces all the data back together, fetching it from whatever data files it came from. So what Audacity does is a little bit different. It's a non-destructive alternative to edit decision lists. What it does is it divides audio data into 2 megabyte chunks, which each has its own file. We call these files block files. So if you import a file, it's going to split that up into a bunch of smaller files and keep them all in a directory. If you cut, copy, paste between tracks, it's going to make more references to the same blocks when it can. But if it has to split blocks, it maintains the invariant that they're between 1 and 2 megs. So if there are a lot of small files, it'll combine them together in an efficient way. Here's just kind of a graphical representation of what I was just talking about. You can see there are a couple of different tracks involved here. And then you have a pool, which is really just the directory of block files. Each one of those files is a little, each one of those blocks is a little file between 1 and 2 megs. And you can see that some of them have references more than once, and that's what's going to happen if you copy and paste between tracks. So the nice thing about this is that the block file interface is pretty simple. All a block file has to be able to do is construct itself using data or some other method, and it just has to be able to implement a read operation. The program asks for some data from that block, and you just have to be able to return it. So this interface allows you to create specialized implementations, which allow for optimizations. For example, a silent block file is a block file that represents silence by only storing its length. Well, it's really easy to implement read then, because all you have to do is return an empty or a buffer of all zeros. Another example is PCM alias block file, which it references an original file instead of copying the data into those little blocks. And so that way, if you open up a big WAV file, you're really not going to create that much extra data because you're going to be referencing the original data instead. So this is all a prelude into a project that I undertook last semester as for a senior thesis, which is lossless editing of lossy compressed sound data, such as MP3 or Ogg Vorbis. The problem is that if you have data that's in an MP3 or Ogg Vorbis format and you try to edit it, what's going to happen is your editor is going to uncompress it when you import, because really editors can only work with uncompressed data unless they're really specialized. So you're going to edit that uncompressed data, and then you're going to export again. And you're going to lose more precision because that's the nature of these lossy formats. So The idea is that these formats, it's usually possible to some extent to be able to make edits on them without having to uncompress and recompress. The way that these formats generally work is that they're based, they're broken into frames or packets depending on the terminology. It depends on the format, what they call it. But the idea is that you can generally, each of these frames has a certain number of samples, and you can rearrange these to some extent. And this could be useful because in Audacity, it's pretty common that people want to make small edits on compressed files, such as cutting a few seconds from the beginning or splitting one file into two. So what you could do is you could import, you could have an exporter that is smart and knows, that can find the original data and piece it together when possible without having to uncompress and recompress. So the way I integrated this into Audacity using the structure that I was telling you about before, the block file structure, is I gave each block file metadata about what file its data originated from. So each block file knows my data came from this compressed MP3 file and this offset in that file. Then I modified the algorithms to preserve that data through all of the edits. So if you copy and paste between tracks, you'll still it'll still maintain that data. It'll still know where it came from. And then in the exporter is smart. The exporter can look at where all that compressed data came from and copy it wherever possible instead of uncompressing and recompressing. So I undertook this project for Ogvorbis just because it's open and I had pretty good access to the developers through the mailing lists. And the results are pretty good. I can theoretically support all cut, copy, paste operations with one minor exception. And it doesn't show up very often. It's the case where you try to take samples from the middle of a compressed packet. Well, since compressed packets are pretty small, that doesn't happen very often. There's one problem, though, that there's a feature of the Vorbis format that should make it so that you can sample accurately cut things, but it hasn't worked the way I expect it to based on the documentation, and a query that I post to the Vorbis list wasn't answered, and so that's really an outstanding issue. I haven't looked into that more since. But, you know, the question arose, do we really need sample accurate editing? To support the kind of edits, I mean, if the packets are small enough, you should be able to do a lot of editing without having to do it sample accurately. So a possible way to work around this is to make it so that when you're editing, selections of audio are going to snap to packet boundaries. That way, automatically, you'll never be trying to split a packet or a frame into two. So that concludes that part. I'll talk now a little bit about some of the legal issues that we've encountered, which is really a surprising amount. It seems like we're always talking about legal issues of some sort. The first one that arose was the fact that the MP3 encoding process is patented. But users want to be able to encode MP3s. It's a popular format, and users expect that. Thomson charges per unit royalties, which would mean that if we wanted to fulfill that, we would have to pay them a certain amount of money for each download of Audacity we ship. We can't do that because we don't charge for Audacity. So our solution to that was to make it easy to use third-party encoders. Basically, our line is that if the user has a way of acquiring an encoder on their own, then we'll make it easy for you to use Audacity with that encoder, but we don't bear any of the responsibility of patent compliance. We pass that responsibility on to the user. Another issue that came up was the fact that VST plugins, it's a real-time plugin interface standard. A lot of people have these plugins, they have a lot of them, they want to be able to use them. But the problem is the only host implementation is non-free in the sense that it's not GPL compatible. Steinberg releases it, they're the ones who have the VST standard. And it's free enough that we can download it and use it, but we can't distribute it in another GPL, which is what it would require. That's our obligation as to be able to distribute Audacity is a whole other GPL. So our solution there was to distribute separately what we call the VST enabler. It's really just a LADSPA to VST bridge. Because Audacity can already deal with LADSPA plugins. LADSPA is another plugin interface. And so as far as Audacity is concerned, it's just loading LADSPA plugins, but the VST enabler allows it to convert that plugin protocol to the VST protocol. Now, this solution required us to, it required an interpretation of the GPL that makes sense to us but doesn't make sense to everyone. For example, the Free Software Foundation disagrees with our interpretation. The question is, if you runtime link two things together on a user's computer, does that create a derived work? If it does, then the whole thing has to fall under the GPL. Well, we don't think it does because we've distributed these parts separately and they're really pretty independent products. However, we talked with our upstream authors to make sure that they agreed, because regardless of our interpretation of the GPL, if they don't agree with the way we're using their software, you know, it's really up to them how they interpret their own license. So we all of our authors of GPL libraries agreed with our interpretation with the exception of one, and that was our resampling library. And since we didn't want to have to drop the resampling feature, Dominic aggregated some code and refined it that was floating around about resampling, and developed his own sample rate conversion library, which he put under the LGPL, which took care of that issue. So something else came up when we found out that there's this company that sells, I'm not sure if they sell it, they have a product called Audacity DVR. That's Digital Voice Recorder. They have a whole suite of products using the Audacity name. And it's similar in scope. It does voice recording, and I was on PDA, so it's not exactly the same thing, but we don't want to. We want to defend our use of that mark. We don't want them to come along at some point and say, we're using this commercially, you have to stop using that name. So what we did is we filed a trademark application, which is still pending, just at, purely as a defensive issue. We're not planning to tell them they have to stop using the name either, but we just want to protect our own name, because we've been using it a lot longer. And actually, just in the last couple of days, we've discovered that they've vastly increased their use of the name Audacity. They seem to be in the midst of a corporate rebranding. They're going to start using the audacityaudio.com domain name, and they've put the Audacity name on their building. So before they're too attached to this name, we hope to enter some kind of talks that will be beneficial to us both. Now, I really love this advertisement here. I just pulled that off eBay a couple days ago. There's a company called Luxuriosity. If you haven't heard of them, they sell a bunch of free software for money, which is fine. They're allowed to do that under the license. Our problem with what they do is that they sell it under a different name, and the reason that they do that is so that no one is really aware that they can download this for free. And so the customers, either the customers or people that see these auctions, come to us and complain about the fact that, you know, people are being duped into something that they could get for free. And the problem that we have is that we've talked with this distributor some, and he listened to what we had to say but didn't really change his tune at all. And the problem that we have is just that he's being deceptive, and instead of trying to add value to Audacity and making money that way, he's trying to make money by deceiving his customers. So we don't really have a solution to that right now. It's ongoing, and we... And with that, I'll pass it over to Dominic, who's going to talk a little bit more about user issues.
All right, I'm going to breeze through a couple more slides and then go right to the demo here. Really briefly, just to try to give an idea of some of the things Audacity can do. We support a zillion formats to import, but if your favorite audio format is not on that list, we can support importing raw audio. And if you don't know what the format was, I mean, it does have to be uncompressed, but if you don't know the format or the Indianness, Audacity will actually guess by running through all the possible formats it knows about and seeing which one generates the most continuous audio signal. It can export to almost all those same formats. You have to use an external library if you want MP3. We have an experimental command line exporter, so in theory, just about any program you want that can create some other format could be integrated very easily into Audacity. Audio input and output is very important. The most important feature we have there is that it works very well on all platforms. We have 32-bit floating point precision up to 96 kilohertz. We know works pretty well, maybe higher. Full duplex means you can play some existing tracks and record on top of that at the same time. Some limited multi-channel input support. Probably in the next 6 months to a year, we'll have support for a lot more sound cards and platforms on that. We have mixer controls built in. Very few programs have this. You can select the input source and the levels directly from within Audacity on all platforms. We have a lot of spectral analysis features. This is something I was really into in grad school, and so you can do spectrograms with customizable FFT sizes. Frequency analysis window, you can also look at like the Kepstrom or autocorrelation to try to determine the pitch or just look at frequency characteristics of the signal. We have lots of effects. We don't claim to have the best effects, but we do claim that for most of the effects that we do have built in, we have a really nice, easy-to-use interface that is powerful enough to do what most people want to do, but also easy enough that people who don't know anything about audio can usually get what they need done. So, for example, noise removal is just a two-step click and you're done process. And changing pitch, we can support, you know, if you know the frequency or if you just know the musical tone. Oh, and by the way, if you select like a single note of audio, it'll actually analyze the frequency and enter the first frequency in for you, so you can see exactly what the frequency was and fix it if you need to fix a vocal recording. Nyquist is it's like a scripting language for audio. It's based on Lisp. It's more of like a functional programming language where audio is a basic type. We've integrated this into Audacity so you can select some audio, type in some Lisp code, and have it execute that right on the audio. I added this about a year ago, and we're kind of still working out the kinks, so we haven't really explored the full potential of this. We think it's pretty cool. And we have a plugin format where you can just type in some Lisp code with some formatted comments, and Audacity will put a little dialogue like that, and so you can easily create a plugin without compiling any code, and it'll work on all platforms. And now time for a demo. So turn on mirroring. That doesn't look like 1024 to me, does it? Oh. This will be much better if I can get 1024. Oh, thank you. Much better. Thank you. Sorry about the delay. The demo that I'm going to be giving here is the idea of a virtual jam session, and this is something I've been kind of into lately. I'm a jazz piano player, and so I'll record the background tracks to a piece and then email an OGG file to a friend. The friend will use Audacity to play that and either sing or record another part on top of that. And so this is an example of something that that I just came up with a few days ago. A friend of mine, and this actually wasn't a very good quality microphone on the trumpet, but I'll mute the backgrounds. So he sent me a file basically like this, and then I mixed them together with my original backgrounds. So to show you how that happens, I'm going to run through a demo. So if anyone's downloaded the audio files, I can walk you through this here. So the other file here is Lady is a Tramp, but we have a backgrounds and vocal part that we just recorded yesterday just for this here. So the background part that I recorded is like this, and I did a little bit of pre-processing. I didn't change the audio, but I did raise the level and line up the tracks appropriately just to save people time. So all you should have to do is import the two files. When Audacity has multiple tracks that are all on the same screen, it automatically mixes them all together. And so that's all you need to do. So you get a result something like this. So let's have a little bit more fun with this. First of all, let's add a little bit of reverb. And I'm not an expert at doing this, but I came up with some settings that seem to sound half decent and hopefully just enough that you'll be able to tell that I added it. If there are any reverb experts, I'd love to learn a little bit more about how to do this right. I'm definitely a musician, not an audiophile. Thanks. So you can hear just a little bit of subtle reverb added to that. One thing let me show you right now. So Audacity has unlimited undo, and one interesting thing you can see there with an undo window there is exactly how much each of the editing operations we've done so far have taken. I guess there were a couple of things that I did before I opened this project. But you can see how large everything is, and the fact that when you applied the reverb effect, it basically had to create 10 megabytes of new audio. And so if you're losing a lot here, you can discard some old undo history with this window. let me try adding a voiceover to that. So the example I wanted to give here is, let's say that my friend Stacy and I wanted to create a demo CD so we can get some gigs. So let me try recording something on top of this. Hello, this is a test. Assuming this is our demo CD, we're going to use... So one thing that we might notice here, I'm not sure how bad the noise level is on this, but let me solo this track and turn up the gain. I'm guessing there was some background noise. Hello, this is a test. So you hear all that background noise. So let's just test the noise removal really quick and see how well that helps. That should be enough to get the profile. So the first step is you select a little bit of silence, and that gives an idea of what the noise is, and then it sort of subtracts out that in frequency space. Hello, this is a test. Assuming this is our demo CD, we're going to use this as an example so that you'll hire us for a lot of gigs. So you can see it got rid of a lot of the noise. It might have distorted the audio a little bit. It's really tricky to kind of set the levels just right so that it doesn't do that. But I'll use that for now. It's not too bad. And the other thing we should probably do is fade the music in. It should probably start at a lower level. So I'm going to use the built-in envelope editor here. You can just set some control points and start the level nice and low. And then slowly have that fade in with the voiceover. And let's see, undo this all and see how that sounds. Hello, this is a test. Assuming this is our demo CD, we're going to use this as an example so that you'll hire us for a lot of gigs.
I get too hungry for dinner at 8. I like the theater, but never go late. I never bother.
Okay, we'll open it up to questions, and I can definitely demo some more features, but let's see what people want to see.
So I'm quite excited about your project here, one that is open source and is multi-track, and I'm a musician and audio engineer as well in my spare time. I have a friend who's blind, and he's often complained that he cannot get into digital recording, at least a laptop or a computer recording, because there's very little in terms of interface for blind people, especially seeing the state of where you're about to record and all sorts of other things. Have you thought of this? Have you thought of how you might represent this to people who cannot see?
It's definitely something we've thought about, and I'd be very interested in getting in contact with your friend and learning some more about this. Out of all of our priorities, it's obviously not the first thing we're thinking about, but as much as possible, when there's something we can do to make it easier for people to work with. One of the things that we did add recently, not just for blind people in particular, but although that was definitely one of the things we thought about, is we have fully customizable keyboard shortcuts. So all of the commands, with exception of effects, someone just mentioned, so we should probably add that. But all of the normal commands, you can add whatever keyboard shortcut you want, and that definitely makes it a lot easier and a lot faster. All of our tools have keyboard shortcuts. All of the audio editing and playing stuff already has shortcuts. However, the ability to really select arbitrary audio is the main problem. And that's something that we haven't addressed yet. And we could probably come up with a couple of quick hacks for that. But we'd love to come up with a really neat solution. We think there's a lot of interesting research that could be done there. So I'd love to talk to you more about that. Thanks.
This is a slightly silly thing to point out. If you implement the packet boundary snap to, what happens when you're editing multiple tracks from several different formats that have packet boundaries that have a very small greatest common denominator?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Just as a quick follow-up to that, the primary users, so there are 100 different things you could do with Audacity. A common use that we've heard is that people will create mixes not in the sense of like combining a whole lot of audio simultaneously, but they'll create like a mixtape where they'll take like five songs and they'll splice them one right after another with maybe a little bit of crossfade. So ideally you could use all of the original compressed audio for everything except maybe the fades between the tracks. So that would be the type of use that we're targeting. Not really if you want to do something with a whole lot of tracks at once, you probably shouldn't work with lossy compressed audio as a starting point.
So have you created a multi-track file format to keep all the tracks together, or are you using individual files and pointers to those, or what?
So the way it works is that for importing and exporting, we use only standard audio formats. And in the middle, and if you want to use this for archive longer time, we use what we call an Audacity project format, which is a directory of all of the intermediate files. All of our intermediate files are .au files, because that's actually the most flexible of the standard, well-supported formats. And we just have an XML file that describes how they're all pieced together. So it may not be well documented, but it's XML and it's readable, so it's open for anyone to work with. So that's kind of the format that we're using. The nice thing about that is, because it's in a directory and we're splitting stuff into blocks, saving and opening a project takes just a couple of seconds, as opposed to like if you have a 1-hour audio project, it could take 5 or 10 minutes to import otherwise. By the way, AIFF does support multi-channel audio, so that's the main format we'd suggest if you needed multi-channel.
Are there any known issues with hardware compatibility?
With hardware compatibility?
Are there any issues?
Yeah.
Well, there are occasionally problems. Most of those are not really Audacity problems, but problems in Port Audio, our Audio I/O library. The most recent example is that we discovered that Apple's new G5 computers, for whatever reason, weren't working with Audacity. And so I spent a few weeks debugging that, and it turns out that by default, the audio format they expect is like a digital compressed format, and so you have to jump through a couple of hoops to tell it to switch into linear PCM mode. But that was a bug in Port Audio, just because no one had actually tested that configuration before. So I fixed that and submitted a patch to the Port Audio team. That type of thing happens every once in a while, but luckily Windows and OSS on Linux are very well known and have been around for a long time, so those work pretty well. Also on Linux is coming along pretty well. So,
One of the things I noticed in the list of supported formats is I didn't see any of the compressed lossless formats like FLAC or Shorten. Are they supported?
They're supported only because no one's written the support yet. I mean, that's actually, FLAC support is something we've intended to do for a while, and just no one's done it. And actually, something that we've thought about doing is making all of those block files FLAC, because our theory is that it wouldn't take very much time to actually do the compression. You might save time because you're doing less disk I/O.
Your fade in and fade out at the first track there, is that modifying the audio on the disk, or is it done in real time? Or
no, it's done in real time. So we have very little in the way of real time processing right now, but mixing and amplitude envelopes are currently done real time.
And we have time for two more questions.
My main complaint with EDLs, and this might just be a complaint with the user interface, is that most of the high-end audio editors force the user to understand how EDLs work and understand the data pool. So my major problem when using tools like Cubase, now Cubase has its own share of problems, but a problem is that you have to be aware of this data pool. And so if you have a whole bunch of audio sources all over your hard disk and you're pulling them into your project, even if I only pull 2 seconds from a 30-minute audio file, it requires that whole audio file to be there, or I have to explicitly tell it to copy that into the project. And so the design goal with Audacity is to create a system that performs as well as edit decision lists without requiring 99% of the users to have to know what it's doing under the hood. Whether we succeeded or not is open for debate, but I guess the only other thing I'd add is that all of that stuff is abstracted, so if there's some feature of EDLs that you really wanted, it would not require totally rewriting Audacity, but rather just kind of implementing an EDL layer in place of the existing block file layer that we have now.
I don't know much about sound editing, but I have a good friend that does a lot on Windows with like Cakewalk or SoundForge or things. What should I tell them about Audacity, either warning them about what it can't do that they're used to or what it does better?
Well, I guess what I usually tell people is it's free, so you've got no reason not to download it. I'd say that because it's free, lots and lots of people use it because everything else is either shareware or broken or Nagware, which is even worse. Also, there are lots and lots of professionals who are using Audacity because either they're programmers or they have friends who are programmers and they can customize it to do really freaky cool things, or just because Audacity has just one feature that happens to work a little bit better than any of the commercial tools, or it's just a little bit easier, faster to use, and so they'll use Audacity in addition to a dozen other professional tools, and it's very valuable to them because of that.
Thank you. That concludes CodeCon 2004. Thank you all for coming.